Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Paramhansa Yogananda. I'm going to make a safe bet that most people just hearing that name right now are hearing it for most likely the first time. Unless you are very interested in Eastern spirituality here in the West, you might not know Paramhansa Yogananda. He came to the United States in 1920 and lived here most of that time, except for a brief excursion to Asia and Europe. But he lived here until 1952. And in that time, he created a very significant work. He introduced much of the United States and the West in general to the yoga tradition that sprung out of Hinduism. In 1946, he wrote his Autobiography of a Yogi, which continues to be a spiritual classic and, disclaimer, one of my favorite books, really. But there was so much about him that never made it into that book. He actually concentrated on writing about other people more than he wrote about himself. For a long time now, people have been wanting to find more and more about this rather incredible gentleman. And it has now happened. Phil Goldberg, who's been on Common Threads before, is the author of this book that is just coming out now called The Life of Yogananda, The Story of the Yogi Who Became the First Modern Guru. A little bit about Phil Goldberg. He grew up in Brooklyn, now lives in L.A. He's a professional writer for more than 40 years. He's the author or co-author of some 25 books published in more than a dozen languages. He's also a skilled public speaker, a workshop leader, a spiritual counselor, and the co-host of the popular podcast Spirit Matters. He blogs at Elephant Journal and Spirituality and Health and contributes to other publications. His most recent book, prior to this one, American Veda, chronicles the impact of India's spiritual teachings on the West. It was named by Huffington Post and Library Journal as one of the top 10 religion books of 2010. And also, I might add, Phil has, over the years, become a good friend. I do spend some time in L.A. these days, and we get together for lunch, and it's one of the high points. So, Phil, welcome to Common Threads.
Hey, Fred. Great to be back on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Phil and I normally meet at a Whole Foods in West Los Angeles and solve the problems of the world. And we're going to do the same thing today, except we're going to let people eavesdrop. So this is good. Phil, we had a couple of discussions, more than a couple of discussions, before this book actually came out. And one of the things that was discussed a couple of times was the fact that this might end up being, I don't want to say a thankless task, but you've been prepared. You've put your armor on, because you said that you were probably going to get it from two different sides. You're going to get it from the people who really identify as Yogananda disciples, saying that it was a hatchet job, and you were also going to get it from non-Yogananda disciples that who might say that this was a love poem to Yogananda, that you're a closet disciple. We should point out, you are very much an expert on the yoga tradition here in the United States. American Veda is absolutely the book that really details the growth of yoga and essentially not just yoga but the religious spiritual teachings of India in the United States. But you do not classify yourself as a disciple. You're not a member of Self Realization Fellowship, the organization that Yogananda founded. Really, many people think that you are the perfect person to write this book. But I am curious, now that it's out, what has been the response?
Let me backtrack and cover some of the points you made, Fred. First, you're right. I'm a long time practitioner and student of Indian philosophy and yogic methodologies. But while I've been influenced by Yogananda ever since I first read Autobiography of a Yogi when I was a young seeker in the late 60s, or maybe it was 1970 when I read Autobiography of a Yogi, I never became a formal student of his or a disciple, which ended up, you know, because I had my own path and my own teachers, and I learned from him as I did others. But it turned out to be good that I didn't become have an affiliation with any of his organizations in his lineage, except as a friendly admirer and researcher when I was writing American Veda and then the biography. So I could take the position, as I did, of being an objective student researching a life that was really extraordinary. But my emphasis was, from day one, to fill in the gaps of his life story that he didn't write about himself and that none of his direct disciples wrote about, and to make it a real biography, not a tribute book, or, as you put it, a love poem, not hagiography, as they say, you know, the life of a saint sort of thing, because I wanted to emphasize the human being who started out life as Mukunda Lal Ghosh and became Paramahansa Yogananda, a global guru of great stature and continuing influence even 66 years after his passing. And so I wanted to emphasize the human story, who he was, what his life was like, what the circumstances were around him historically, socially, economically, and so forth, that formed the human being that became the famous guru. That was my goal. That's what I set out to do. Now, to end it with respect to your first question, I would soften it a bit. I expect, and I write this in the introduction to the book, that there will be people on both extremes who will take exception to parts of the book or some of what I did. And that's just to be expected. It happens all the time to writers of biographies. It happened to me in American Veda. In American Veda, I covered all the gurus who ever came here, and I would hear, you know, you were too kind to those charlatans on one extreme, and then it was, you didn't convey adequately the greatness of my guru on the other extreme. And I expect a similar thing will happen with Yogananda, not from, you know, ordinary disciples. I'm satisfied, and the feedback I've gotten so far has been very encouraging, that they will see that I handled the subject with respect and fairness and honesty, and that I obviously admire the subject of the book. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother, you know, writing a biography. So it was never intended to be a hatchet job. I just went where the facts and the evidence took me. And when it came to certain controversial aspects of his life, that are, I say controversial because people still argue about them, even, you know, certain incidents that happened 70, 80 years ago or more. And I just follow the evidence, and I know there'll be diehard sort of orthodox devotees who will say, oh, I didn't capture the greatness of Yogananda. He was a supreme avatar, and I emphasized the human qualities too much. And And I'll get it from people who are, you know, convinced that Yogananda was a fraud and a reprobate in different ways. And they'll tell me I was too kind to him, or I didn't. As you put it, a closet disciple. I just expect that to happen. There are extremists on both sides. But the overwhelming majority of people who admire Yogananda, who are devotees of Yogananda and serious students of Yogananda, I'm satisfied they will find the book illuminating, because they'll learn things they never knew, and fair and honest. And that's the feedback I've gotten so far from people who matter.
Now, Yogananda, I mentioned before, he founded an organization. In 1917, he founded Yogoda Satsanga Society in India, and then he brought that organization, in a manner of speaking, to the United States, and later renamed it Self-Realization Fellowship. And so there are monks and nuns of the Swami Order who continue to serve this day, and as far as dispersing the teachings of Yogananda. And before American Veda, did you have any relationship with them? Because you formed a relationship with them. Am I correct? That was the genesis of your real relationship with SRF, was when you approached them for American Veda? Or does it
Yes, I was researching Yogananda and his legacy, and so I reached out to the people who represent that lineage now, and I earned their respect the way I handled things in American Veda, not just SRF, but some of the small sort of breakaway lineages, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was, you know, I moved to Southern California in the 80s, and, you know, I count myself a yogi and a meditator, and here, Yogananda, I always say that he had the best real estate karma of all the gurus who ever came to the West, and they have properties that are exquisitely beautiful and sort of peaceful oases in the midst of the craziness that could be life here in L.A. and Southern California. So I would visit on occasion, especially the lake shrine that you're familiar with.
Very, it's
stunning.
But
that was it. That and, you know, in my my own personal spiritual life, he was one of the many touchstones whom I would quote or look up something about in his Bhagavad Gita or his autobiography and that sort of thing. But it was only when I started researching American Veda that I dug deeper into his life, and that was really the genesis of this biography, because I found his life story so compelling, but I could only devote, you know, a small chapter to it. And so I had in the back of my mind, gee, maybe, you know, if no one else does it, before I get around to it, I could write the full-on biography. And that's what ended up happening.
And my next question I will ask as soon as I remind people that they're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and my guest today is Phil Goldberg, author of The Life of Yogananda, The Story of the Yogi Who Became the First Modern Guru. So my question was that you started this relationship with American Veda, with Self-Realization Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, did they approach you about writing this book, or was it vice versa?
No. It was my idea. And I went to them and I said, I'm thinking of doing this. My first question was, is anybody else doing it? Because I didn't want to start doing something that somebody would beat me to the punch, would be useless. And no one was. No one from the outside. And they recognized, to their credit, that having a knowledgeable person with some credibility write a biography of Yogananda from an objective outsider's point of view would be of value. And so I asked if they'd cooperate, and because they're, you know, the keeper of the archives. They have documents and materials that, you know, exist nowhere else, and I needed their cooperation. And they agreed to cooperate, and so we had a mutually supportive relationship, as I did with other people who are unofficial archivists of, you know, Yogananda's life. He affected a great many people, and people have done research and compiled their own collection of documents and that sort of thing. So I reached out as much as I could to all the sources. But yeah, that's how it happened.
And I can only imagine that there must be this creative tension, if you will. Here you have his organization that looks upon him in a certain way, at knowing that you, possibly looking upon him in a different way, are going to create this book. And there is cooperation, but perhaps was there any anxiety that you may have seen on their side? That what in the world is this finished product?
They're all, you know, practicing yogis who practice the teachings Yogananda prescribed faithfully, and they are tasked with representing his legacy. So if there was anxiety, it was not visible. But I would say, of course, they were concerned. You know, their job is to, you know, make sure anything written about Yogananda, their job with respect to people on the outside like me, is to make sure that, in protecting his legacy and the image of the organization and the teachings, that they're represented honestly and appropriately. Now, they understood right at the beginning that I, as a non-disciple, would write a different book than they would. They got that. They understood it. They knew there'd be value in it. Their concern was that I get the facts right and that it's overall handled in a respectful and balanced and fair way. So when it came to writing about controversial stuff or stuff about which there's been, you know, a lot of speculation and so forth, they showed me documents that I could not have found anywhere else that were useful. They corrected mistakes in fact and history that I had come across that would have been in the book if they had not corrected them, and I was grateful for that. And there were things that they said, well, would you, you know, we say it this way. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, I'm not you.
Right.
I'm a writer from the outside, and I would say it this way. And we had a lot of, you know, mutually respectful conversations of that regard.
Well, that's very good. So tell us a little bit, who was Yogananda?
A good question. Well, as you said in your setup, you know, Yogananda came here in 1920. He wrote about his childhood and adolescence and teen years in India in his own autobiography, but there was still a lot to uncover. And I one of the things I tried to do was give it historical perspective and place him in a time and place. You know, India under the British Empire, India during World War One, India, especially Calcutta, at the beginning of the Freedom Revolution. What kind of schools did he go to? What were the influences and so forth? So I did a lot about the years in India. He came here in 1920. He was 27 years old. And some of the things you learn as you grow up is not only the influences on him, but the, you know, who he was, just because he was who he was, whether you think of it as genetics or, you know, whatever you ascribe individual human nature to, he was marked at a very early age for, you know, being a spiritual leader and teacher. I mean, he knew that was his destiny when he was a kid. He even tried to run away to the Himalayas to live like the, you know, renunciate yogis that you read about when he was 11 years old. You know, and they apprehended him and brought him back. And this happened a few times. And, you know, when he was a teenager in Calcutta, you know, it was remarkable. You know, we all know these teenagers who are sort of natural leaders. We call them ringleaders, instigators, and they're either, you know, cooking up a mischief or, you know, a ball game or a party or whatever. And Yogananda was, you know, cooking up, you know, visits to temples and going to see gurus and saints and learning yogic methodologies and gathering his group of fellow seekers and even started a little ashram when he was 15. So all that is, you know, in the book, and a lot of which is not in, in his autobiography. But only about a third of my book is about his life before he came here. So I was trying to add balance to the overall picture, because less than 10% of his autobiography is about his life after he came to the West. So two-thirds of mine is, and I filled in, you know, all the gaps that he left out.
Yeah, that is amazing. People who read his autobiography would really be amazed at as to how little he writes about his work in America. And he was here for all these years, from 20 to 52, with the exception of a trip, as I say, to Europe and Asia.
It's amazing. And, you know, those are the years that made him who he was, and where he establishes his teachings and his legacy, that, you know, and his, it's almost his whole adult life. He was only 27 when he came here.
Well, let me ask you this. In your research, do you have any idea why he did not write as much as perhaps
that's
you
a, it's a
wanted?
Good question. You know, his autobiography didn't start out as an autobiography. You may know this, Fred, but he started out researching and writing a book that he was going to call The Yogi Christs of India.
Yes.
And so he had, it ended up being a kind of hybrid of that and an autobiography. And part of its charm, or, you know, to many people, is these tales of these yogis who he either met or heard about, who, you know, do miraculous things and are remarkable human beings, and who helped him become the knowledgeable yogi he ended up becoming. His mentors, you could say, and just, you know, a lot of spectacularly interesting stories. So maybe it was just, you know, there's just too little space in his book to include more facts about his life and work here. Or it was just his inclination. You know, for example, there's a one sentence in his book about the 3 or 4 years he spends in Boston, where he first arrived. And it says something like, you know, years passed, and
yes,
I was teaching in Boston. It's something like that.
Yes.
Well, you know, those were significant years. A lot happened. They laid the foundation for his future work. So, you know, I have a whole chapter on it. And, you know, and then he has this cross-country trip in an automobile, which he, you know, he writes about a bit, but there was so much more to be said, and on and on like that throughout his, you know, essentially 32 years in the West, you know, establishing his teachings and the lasting legacy. So I don't know the reason he did it. Maybe it was less interesting to him. Maybe it didn't fit that overall theme of, you know, the delivering to people the tales of yogis and the yogic philosophy Not sure why he didn't, but it opened the gates for me to fill in the gaps. So well, I did the best I could.
He knew you were coming.
Okay. I'll take that on advisement.
And so in these early years, give us, we've got 3 minutes before we have to end our program today. Can you give us a short story that people might not know from the early days, from the Boston days?
Well, yeah, there's probably a lot of specifics, but one thing that stood out for me about his whole mission to the West, and you start to see it in the early days in Boston, and then it gets more and more the case, is how hard he worked, how difficult it was, and how many challenges he had, and how much he had to agonize. He was not just a spiritual teacher. He was just not just a guru in the usual sense of the word, but he had a mission to reach large numbers of people. That meant you needed to have an organization and you needed to have money. These are not things he was inclined to deal with or manage. It's not what his preference was, but he learned the necessity of it very early on in Boston. When people convinced him, no, you have to advertise, and no, you need to charge for the classes, not just rely on donations. That's the American way. Otherwise, there's no income. And you start to see very early, before he's even 30, he's just adapting to life in America, which seemed this very strange place where people were reacting to this dark-skinned man with long hair and strange clothing. In all kinds of ways, either as a curiosity or in even hostile ways. It was, the 20s. It was racism. And so while he's adapting to all this new world as a sort of stranger in a strange land, he's also trying to build his teachings and his organization and getting advice from people. And you see that right at the beginning, and it continues throughout. He never did stop worrying about having enough money to finance the effort.
Well, let's leave it right there because we are down to the wire. But, of course, Phil, we have so much more to talk about.
I'll come back next week, Fred.
Why don't you do that, Phil? So in fact, that is what will happen. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today, Phil Goldberg, the author of The Life of Yogananda, The Story of the Yogi Who Became the First Modern Guru. Please join us again next week. We'll have more of this fascinating conversation. This is WGVU-FM. Them.